The Gospels, a commentary. Professor Anthony Frendel and Professor Peter Bassano discuss excerpts from the Gospels. Readings by Patricia Camilleri. A reading from Matthew 17, verses 1 to 9. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and his brother John, and led them up a high mountain where they could be alone. There, in their presence, he was transfigured. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Suddenly, Moses and Elijah appeared to them. They were talking with him. Then Peter spoke to Jesus. "Lord," he said, "it is wonderful for us to be here. If you wish, I will make three tents here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He was still speaking when suddenly a bright cloud covered them with shadow. And from the cloud there came a voice which said, "This is my Son, the Beloved. He enjoys my favor. Listen to him." When they heard this, the disciples fell on their faces, overcome with fear. But Jesus came up and touched them. "Stand up," he said. "Do not be afraid." And when they raised their eyes, they saw no one but only Jesus.
So, Peter, we're faced with an interesting text for our conversation, I think, today, which has echoes in other New Testament passages. This is the transfiguration, according the transfiguration of Jesus, according to the version of Saint Matthew. I would like to start by making some remarks on the literary allusions to the Old Testament. First of all, by way of introduction, I would like to say that this section from the Gospel of St. Matthew should be latched onto the narrative which precedes this narrative for today's consideration, namely Matthew chapter 16, verse 16, where Peter, Simon Peter, had made his confession of faith in Jesus as the Messiah when he had said, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." So the text starts by saying 6 days later, which means 6 days after Peter had made his confession. We've got here the motifs of a mountain, which echoes Mount Sinai. We'll say why later on. There is the motif that the three disciples chosen, the three apostles chosen, are alone with Jesus on the mountain, which echoes Moses being alone with God on the mountain. There is the idea of a divine encounter, and also the underscoring of the fact that Moses and Elijah appear together with Jesus to the apostles, which is an allusion to the fact that in the Old Testament, Elijah and Moses were the only ones to have been present on Mount Sinai. Again, an echo that Matthew wants to say that Jesus is the new Moses, but as we shall see further on in our discussion, he's much more than just a Moses. I don't know whether this brings things to your mind which you would like to converse on before we go further into the text.
Yes, I'd comment on the fact that we are told it was Peter, James and John. Peter, not Simon Peter, so already his new title has been given him, which is Petrus, the rock, in a sense, for my namesake. There was a sense of choice. He chose those three. One here, there's a sense of speculation, I have to admit. Perhaps the three who would most understand this deep, profound significance of a transformation which actually takes place in front of them. something they've never experienced before. This is the sublime manifestation of the Son of God, I would have thought. And it is, as you say, as you point out, a continuation almost of a narrative where Saint Peter, by a kind of divine inspiration, not only of his own reasoning or perception, says something, the import of which he doesn't himself quite understand. And he is, of course, he not quite confesses, but he actually defines, who do you think I am? And where the others were saying, Saint John returned, or a prophet, he is inspired enough, feels inspired to say, you are Christ, son of the living God. And that is where now Peter becomes the leader. It's a point where he's transformed from Shimon, the fisherman, to the leader of a new sect, I would have thought.
Yes.
So there's a sense of things happening, a continuation of an experience, which the import of which they cannot quite understand.
Precisely. I wholly agree with what you say. In fact, Matthew painstakingly tries to, in his own way, and according to the literary genre of the age, tries to transmit precisely the message which you've just underscored, I must say. And therefore I would like to dwell a bit on these literary allusions which he makes in order to bring out exactly what you've just said. First of all, what had happened, the confession of Peter, when he said, as you say, not just on his own human instinct, but prompted by divine inspiration, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God, that episode had actually taken place at Caesarea Philippi, which is in the extreme northern part of modern-day Israel, and where we know from research that nearby there was a cave dotted at the time with the statues of pagan gods and goddesses. And Jesus asks the question precisely in that context, in that physical context, so as to bring forth from Peter the answer you've mentioned in a context where there were other statues of gods, as if to say, look, there are no gods. I am the living God you're seeing. That's just by way of context. Then if we come back to our own passage, if one reads chapter 24, or a part of chapter 24 of the book of Exodus, Moses, in verse 16 of that chapter, is depicted as the prophet who is on Mount Sinai where he meets God, and a cloud covered the area for 6 days. So the 6 days are also not just a chronological indicator here in Matthew, but an allusion to an allusion to the fact that Moses encountered the divine. The other thing is that we've got here an emphasis on Jesus Christ as a new Moses, but also much more than that. Now, Jesus' face shone like the sun, says our narrative. And this echoes Moses' face, which is shining in Exodus chapter 23. When he encounters God, his face shone. That's what happened to Moses. That's what happens to Jesus. But obviously there's a difference, because Jesus is not only encountering God, he is God who is encountering the chosen ones, as you say. The radiant face indicates, even in the Gospels elsewhere, the allusion to the divine world. So we are here in a divine spectrum, I must say. The passage for our consideration is a foretaste of the vision of the Son of Man's own glory, as pointed out in verse 28 of chapter 16, the last verse before our passage, which says, truly I tell you, there are some standing here who will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And finally, the bright cloud and a voice speaking from the cloud are also found in the narrative of Exodus chapter 24, especially verse 16. And finally, Moses and Elijah, as I said, are the only figures in the Old Testament whom we see conversing with God on Mount Sinai. And this means that Matthew wants to underscore the fact that here we have a new Moses, but indeed someone greater than just Moses. How do we know this? Well, I'll leave you to make your own reflections on that, and then I'll pull out some other texts which prove that Jesus is not just a new Moses, but somebody greater than a new Moses, according to the text which we have here.
Yeah. My interest, as you know, as we've been discussing, is in the narratological part of it, narration. And from a literary point of view, as we have been saying in our first sessions on this, and here you have a scene of ascent, they're going up a mountain, these three hand-picked disciples, Christ leading them up, presumably. Then you have this wondrous transformation. And one of the details, I think, is that no water could have washed linen so white.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
In other words, it's something that looks human and isn't, belongs to the world and isn't. It's transcendent. It's going beyond. So they are moving out of their element. I think it's very important that they should be going upward. The mountain is important. Moses went to the mountain.
The narrative
narrative brings this out.
Exactly.
But also, you see it, the impact of this wondrous transformation, which comes in rather slowly at first. They're quite amazed. The sudden transfiguration, as we call it, the cloud, which the narrative seems to reveal and withhold, to disclose and to obscure the cloud. And there's a point at which Peter, in his excitement, in being overwhelmed by the situation, seems to say, look, to disguise his own fear, his own apprehension, he said, well, how nice it is, I will have three tents put along. Side by side, one for me and one for each one of us. And, there's a point here which is interesting. Peter looks, he's the one to speak, isn't he? He's the one to speak.
Right.
He's now the leader, he has to speak. This part of that speech is partly disguising a bit of his own inward misgivings and fear, because they're now coming into a different sphere of a voice coming on telling, this is my son in whom I am well pleased. It also shows a movement from the Son of Man, that very enigmatic phrase which Christ used about himself, to the Son of God. It is the first inkling that he is the Son of God without his actually saying it.
That's right.
And Christ made Peter say it himself.
It's illusions, basically.
Illusion. Yeah. It's elusive. But he sort of elicited the answer from Peter. And when the answer came, it was the right answer, he tells him, blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonah, because this has been revealed to you by my Father in heaven. You couldn't have come to that conclusion on
your own. Exactly.
Yes.
And in fact, again, I think Matthew uses his own techniques, the techniques of the scriptural techniques current in his age, in order to bring out this aspect which you've just mentioned, this, so to say, going beyond the Son of Man to the Son of God. When he pulls up this text, when Matthew pulls up this text and says, quotes the voice from heaven as saying, this is my son, the beloved, with him I am well pleased, listen to him, we've got here two very important textual notes to make. First of all, listen to him is an allusion to Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 15 and 18, where the text speaks of a prophet who will come in the future like Moses, and it says, hear him. They will listen to him. So this is saying, look, this is the new Moses, but then it goes much more beyond, as you say, in that phrase, this is my son, the beloved. This is a quotation, I must say, from Isaiah chapter 42, verse 1. Now, if one goes to the original Hebrew text, that original Hebrew text says, this is my servant in whom I am well pleased. But what happens? The official Greek translation from Hebrew into Greek by Jews, for Jews who no longer understood Hebrew, picks on an ambiguous Greek word, pais. And pais in Greek could mean either of two things. Either servant, therefore reflecting the original Hebrew text, or son. What does Matthew do? When he quotes this text, he doesn't use the word pais anymore, but which could mean son, but could also mean servant. He uses the word huios, which means only son, to emphasize the fact that this is my son, therefore the son of God. And the other thing which I would like to point out is that Mark's parallel version speaks of rabbi in this context. Rabbi, let us make three tenses here. Whereas in Matthew, Peter is made to say by Matthew, Lord, Kurie, Lord. So this is God, this is the Son of God himself. And this, I think, clinches all that you've been saying and that I've been trying to say. I hope clearly enough.
Absolutely. One other thing from a narrative point of view, I find, I found a little bit perplexing here, because we are told that at that time they saw him conversing with two figures, men, who are Moses and Elijah. And yet, how would they have been able to tell their identity? How could they come to the conclusion that those two and Matthew himself, with a certain amount of certainty, looking at him, and he was disclosing. Now, obviously, what they would have been looking at would be, something like Christ with two presumably older figures.
And it would be mainly, more than anything else, a unique understanding via conversation with Christ. They were set apart, remember. This was a unique experience where Christ would have explained many things to them, and Matthew would have relayed it this way to underscore two things, that Moses stands for the law and Elijah stands for the prophets, which means this would have been more than anything else in this particular case of these two characters, a spiritual intellectual insight, which was unique and God-given by Christ, that he made them somehow understand what they did not understand before, that Jesus is the fulfillment of the law and the prophets, and that he is the scriptures in his own person. And this would have overwhelmed them, I mean, not so much visually as spiritually and intellectually, I must say. And this encounter made an impression on them, but was mainly through dialogue with Christ that they understood what the text is trying to point out.
Yeah.
And I must say, from the literary point of view, I mean, this is more your aspect. There is here, the way Matthew relayed the text, a parallel with what is going to happen at the cross, under the cross. We have Jesus is transfigured here. He's the Son of God, seen to be so by the chosen ones. On the cross, he's humiliated. There's a contrast. Yeah. There's Moses and Elijah, two figures accompanying him, so this understanding. But on the cross, there are two thieves. Everything is light here, dazzling white, as you correctly pointed out. On the cross, everything is darkness. And there are three onlookers here, Peter, James, and John, and there are three onlookers under the cross, Mary, the other Mary, and John. I don't know whether this intrigues you from the literary point of view.
It's interesting because you notice somehow that there's a strong intertextual layer of meaning where it almost sounds as if it's written over a kind of, in a kind of palimpsest.
That's it.
Scarcely rubbed off, and yet again, so that the older meaning and the new are conflated.
That's it.
And this is what I find intriguing.
Exactly.
And the point where it happens seems to be this transfiguration of the Son of Man into the Son of God, where God identifies him as, this is my son.
He always was so, but he made it apparently so now.
Yes.
Exactly, that is,
yes,
it. Yeah.
That's it. He always was so.
Yes, that's right.
But now it becomes apparent. But what I find, again, intriguing is that the moment they seem to go down the mountain, and the vision is over, and the and things go back slowly to normality, where they left off, he seems to give them, he, Christ, seems to give them an injunction, which is strongly worded, do not tell anybody,
yes,
of this.
Hey, this is intriguing.
It's intriguing,
I think, because he wanted people to understand it gradually. And he chose these three, I would imagine, we don't have it in the text, because he knew that they were perhaps predisposed to understand better and to receive better what he's trying to reveal to them. And when you spoke of intertextuality, did this parallelism by contrast between what is happening here in the Transfiguration on the mountain and on the cross, Matthew understands the experience and the knowledge which they got as being clinched in this argument. Jesus is the Son of God, both on the mountain in the Transfiguration experience and on the cross when this aspect is hidden but still there.
Yes. I'm also thinking in terms of perhaps there are many injunctions by Christ to the apostles not to say anything.
Yes.
Even when he's performed some wonder, he's saying, no, you just don't say anything. There's a sense of the time not yet not yet come.
Precisely.
It's not fulfilled. There's something that has to be fulfilled.
Yes. I wholly agree with this. In fact, you've touched on a point which has belabored scholars, I think, for a very long time. Technically, what you've said has been summarized by scholars as the so-called messianic secret.
Mm-hmm.
Especially this happens also in Mark, and as you say, in other passages of the Gospel. And I think the reasons would be precisely the ones you've just mentioned, and perhaps also the fact that what Messiah meant was extremely ambiguous in the first century AD.
Mm-hmm.
There are about three or four, let's say, major ideas running around in Israel on what Messiah meant. Some people understood the Messiah to be the promised one who would come to deliver the Jews from the hand of the Romans,
yeah,
a political liberator.
Yeah.
Others would have understood the Messiah as a terrorist who would liberate the Romans via violent means. Still others would have had perhaps ambiguous ideas. But then there was the fourth idea, and that was Jesus' idea, picking on the Messiah as the fulfillment of the suffering servant of God depicted in Isaiah chapters 42 at Sequentia, and that was not common, and that was a scandal. But he picked on a text which they knew, which was true and had to be fulfilled, and he picked on the one which they least expected. And I think he says, don't say it now, because there's a risk of my being misunderstood. In fact, if he said openly that he is the Messiah, they would have come, as they did in the Gospel of John, to proclaim him king, which,
yes,
he did not want.
No, of course not.
I don't know whether that answers...
Yes, possibly so. One thing that comes to mind is this curious incident when it seems Jesus' controversial brethren who see him perform such miracles go to him and say, but you're wasting your talent here in Judea when nobody seems to know of you. Why don't you go to Jerusalem and proclaim yourself there? And Jesus again tells them, because my time has not yet come.
That's it. I think that summarizes precisely why there is this so-called messianic secret, mm-hmm. because he knew that if he said openly immediately that he is the Messiah, people would have taken it in the way they wanted, whereas he wanted gradually to show that he is the incarnation of absolute mercy, that he uses not earthly power and violence, but peace and humility to get through his message and show who he really is. And I think in this sense, this idea of my time has not yet come fits in perfectly with why he reveals himself gradually and to the select few and openly only at the end.
And allowing his audience and people around him to make connections and come to their own conclusions,
exactly.
rather than, you know, because he did the same with Peter. Who do you think I am? Not I am telling you I am.
Exactly, because in modern day terminology, you would say faith appeals to freedom.
Yeah.
That was Professor Anthony Frendall and Professor Peter Barsalo discussing the gospel passage chosen for today's commentary.